6 savage seasons all in a row. 6 scary seasons for the beast to grow. 6 wicked seasons to keep you up all night. 6 nasty reasons for your wicked delight. 6 wicked seasons that you thought was scary. Wait till season 7 of The Wicked Library. September 2016. Visit thewickedlibrary.com. From Society 13, Redefining Podcasts.
Before you listen to this podcast, be aware this show often uses very naughty language. If you don't like that, you shouldn't listen. Send your complaints to I Am a Whiny Baby with No Sense of Humor at nightstory.com or stop by the studio. I'll take you for a ride to a story of my choosing.
Hey everybody, it's John here from Red Horse Radio. Join me over at the Night Story Podcast. I'm hanging out with Victoria. We like to giggle and ride elevators and stuff, and of course, tell stories. You're listening to the Night Story Podcast.
Everything eventually comes down to a choice. In such a big world, so many choices. Here, in this little lost place, things are simpler. You'll find it because you are meant to. And inside, you'll find my lift and me. I'll take you where you need to go, and then you choose. Once you do, things will get much better. Or much worse. Find the lift at victoriouslift.com and also in iTunes at itunes.victoriouslift.com.
Once upon a time. Once upon a time.
Come along as we examine the many things that combine to create the magic that is story. Next up, the Night Story.
So, welcome to the Night Story Podcast. Our guests today are Jacob and Sam from Just the Story Podcast. And for those who are uninitiated and haven't heard the show, what is Just the Story all about?
Well, I'll start with the tagline. Each week, we take a look at the stories we tell over and over again and what our fears and fables, myths and misdeeds say about us as humans. It's a conversation discussion show that we started to talk about urban legends.
Yeah, we use the urban legends really as like a jumping off point to talk about all sorts of things.
That's awesome. It's a great show. It's a lot of fun. And, you know, it's really interesting, the common legends that we've developed recently. And it just really speaks to us as being story machines, because, you know, if you look at folk tales and folklore and tall tales, and we always tell stories and we're always updating them. But there's always that common element where it's kind of like a warning aspect, isn't there?
Yes, absolutely. A lot of them are cautionary tales. And it's interesting to look at some that have kind of fallen out of fashion. Like we did the Avon Lady story a while back. Mm-hmm. And it was almost warning women not to go into the workplace, you know, like not to leave home, and that they needed to stay home and be domestic or bad things would, you know, don't trust those women kind of thing.
Right.
So, you know, those are like neat little artifacts. And then you have some that are thoroughly modern, that are kind of more internet age, that really speak to what's going on in the collective unconscious now.
Yeah.
And so it's fun to kind of set those against each other.
Do you have a favorite story that you've done recently?
I really like stories like the Avon Lady, where it's like a really stupid legend, and we're able to find very modern commentary and look at it in a really different way. Like when I'm kind of surprised how well the episodes come out, like when I think, oh, what are we ever going to do with this? And then we end up going into like bathroom rights issues and gender identity, you know, at the end of the episode.
I really like when we just did, and I was just so excited about the response, because almost sometimes we do ones we know people are gonna love this, they're gonna be interested, and sometimes we do stuff where we're like, oh, this is super interesting, we have to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And one that we recently did was about Kitty Genovese. Which if you've taken a Psych 101 class, you've heard about it. It's the classic story about bystander apathy, where a young girl was supposedly killed in New York in the 60s, and no one helped her. No one came out, and there were 38 or so witnesses, and no one helped.
Mm-hmm.
And we really dug into the history behind that story and what it kind of means about us as a society, because the idea of these 38 people that just didn't help us, completely not true.
Right.
And it was a story that was created at that time and has become almost legend and is in every psych textbook.
It's reported mm-hmm. as fact to this day, which is so interesting.
Yeah. I mean, the last episode of Seinfeld was kind of loosely based on that.
Right. Yes. And Princess Diana, all that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we try to make as many Seinfeld references as possible.
It's our goal. We try to do a Seinfeld reference, mention Freud, the DSM, and Texas in every episode. And if we can do that, we've like get an extra glass of wine.
That's tremendous. So where did the title for the show come from? I mean, I see it as two different meanings, but I'll let you.
Well, we love the way that people will kind of correct you when you tell it, like when you're reporting an urban legend as fact. They're like, no, that's just a story.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's also like the starting off point, like, well, it's just a story. And then we dig into it, and there's a lot more to it than just the text of the story.
Mm-hmm.
It works on a lot of levels, which is like exciting to me. I like when I twist it and look at it differently.
Yeah, I always like it whenever something has multiple layers to it, you know, because there's also the kind of sarcastic factor to that as well, which is nothing is just a story. There's always so much more to it. And it means so much more because we, like you said, we bind ourselves in our culture, and it really tells a lot about who we are and where we are and why we are the way we are.
No, definitely. That's kind of our whole goal, really, is to just dig into it and look at that. Why are we telling this? Why is this stuck around for 70 years? Why are people still telling the story about the crazed person with the hook coming and trying to kill people that are making out or whatever in the back of a car?
Yeah.
You know, why is that still being told? Because no one's actually, well, I guess some people might be, but people aren't really driving up to Lover's Lane, you know?
I grew up in the country. That was the thing.
Fine.
So people are still doing it.
Yeah.
That one is a fascinating legend because I don't know if I'm sure. Have you done that as an episode? Because now I need to listen to it.
Oh, yeah. It's episode 7.
Hooking up.
And episode 7. It's one of my favorite early ones. And yeah, and because that one actually kind of happened.
Uh-oh.
So I was really excited when I left, suddenly, that you were talking about the Monster Florence, because I recently read the book, The Monster Florence, and it's I'm very excited that that connects.
Yeah,
the last words that I heard were, it actually kind of happened, and I was like, oh no, that was fascinating. It's always the worst spot.
You didn't hear either.
No, I did not.
So first there are some murders that happen in Texarkana in the 50s.
The Moonlight Murders.
Oh.
They call the guy that committed those the Phantom Killer. And he wore like a white bag over his head and had like a super creepy plain mask thing and would go and kill people in Lover's Lanes. And then, but he didn't have a hook, alas. And then there was the Monster of Florence, which was in Florence, and mm-hmm. it was the guy's never been caught. It
It was Lover's Lane.
It was Lover's Lane killings. It took place over a span of like 15 years or so.
And he's still out there.
Yeah. And eventually the Italian government decided it was like related to occult practices and crazy monks and stuff because they're Italian and that's what they do.
Oh, wow.
And it was super fun and entertaining. So I recommend the book.
That's fantastic.
And it's actually the Monster Florence trial was actually what Hannibal was based off of.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I did not realize that. That's very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, the scenes in, I think it's Red Dragon. That's kind of why it's like in Italy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All makes sense.
Yeah, where he's stalking me as the harpy.
Yeah.
The curved knife.
Yeah. And then he eats the brain.
Yeah.
That's the creepiest scene. Anyway.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we do sometimes do movies too that have kind of developed legends and use those as jumping off points. Like we did Amityville Horror.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Incredibly fun to research.
And The Exorcist is one of my favorite movie ones where we looked into the like science behind demonic possession and what psychology thinks about it and the different neuro research into like how people use something called the God helmet to induce these kind of visions of God and things like that. That was a super fun one.
And I love doing the Hitchcock research because I love Alfred Hitchcock probably more than about anybody. And we did a Psycho episode and that was so much fun. I got to spend a week listening to old like newsreels and press releases from him. And just like fully saturating myself in his brand of like dignified horror.
Yeah.
Which I mean, if there's nothing better than that, I don't think. And then we did an Indiana Jones episode recently, which was also really fun research. Although if the NSA hadn't flagged me before, which seems impossible, I know I have been now because I've been researching Nazis like crazy. So I'm done.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. Never mess with the browser history of a writer because it always looks
like all of the scary things.
Exactly.
I saw a great McSweeney's once and it was just a girl listing her browsing history. And it was like all this weird research for books she was writing. And it was like my ex-boyfriend. My ex-boyfriend's new girlfriend I found on Facebook. My ex-boyfriend's new girlfriend I found on Facebook again, a little too much. And like things like that. It was really funny.
That's tremendous. So you guys are horror fans, I would assume.
Yes.
Definitely.
Yeah, you did the Black Eyed Kids in your recent was called Suffer the Little Children, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we try to come up with the catchiest titles possible.
Yeah.
It's so funny. I love the extra effort that goes into coming up with a great title for it. But that was always one of the modern ones that I found very interesting because it has so many of those old fairy tale and vampire elements to it. You know, like they can't get in unless you invite them in. Which, you know, applies to fairy and it applies to vampires and lots of other things. You know, it's almost like you have to open yourself up to that in order to get the bad juju coming at you.
But it's someone's really honed in on how to make that even creepier and even harder to resist by making it a child.
Right. Yeah. Taking that scary innocence of children and then giving them those powers to kind of put you in that daze like vampires do and kind of trick you into letting them in.
Yeah.
It's a great legend. Somebody like if someone consciously sat down and came up with it, I'm impressed because it is it hits on a lot of things. We could have recorded that for about 7 hours like that. We had so much research.
Yeah, it's a great topic. I mean, that's and you're right. That's one of the things that I've always been the most creeped out by. And maybe that starts with The Shining and, you know, like the early
night. That is my ultimate favorite part. Best ever.
Yeah. I mean, just, you know, the two little girls at the end of the, I mean, that always freaked me out because my name's, when I was a kid, everybody called me Danny. So, you know, when to me, they were talking right to me and that always terrified me.
Did you have a big wheel?
I did have a big wheel. I did. I did not have a green machine, but I had a big wheel.
Close.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was, it's where, you know, when I started doing the ninth story, I wanted kind of like a mascot, and Victoria, who started out kind of as this ethereal voice and has become a lot more, came from that, largely inspired by the way that I was creeped out by The Shining. And there's just always something about, you expect kids to be innocent and pure, and when they're not, it's just like even more terrifying. There's just something, I think, deep down inside of us that is just terrified by that concept.
Well, I think you touch on something that's so interesting with Victoria, and it's been mentioned in a lot of stories on the lift. Different writers will allude to it, is like, she knows more than a child should know.
Right.
And that's very unsettling. And I think there's something that is so hard as an adult to process about that. Like, I always think back to the Interview with the Vampire movie that I snuck and watched when I wasn't supposed to when I was a kid. And that scene where Kirsten Dunst is like 9 and looks like an angel, and she cuts all her hair off. Mm-hmm. She wants to look different. She wants to not look like a child anymore. And she cuts all her hair off, like at the root, and it all grows back, and she screams because she's just so angry. She's trapped in this child's body, but has had all this life experience. Mm-hmm. I think that's just like creepy and weird, and it gets all over me. That's scary.
Yeah. It's that uncanny valley thing. It's really strange. And it definitely tears, you know, it tears into something deep in us that, you know, we expect we're supposed to protect the children. So our defenses are down with them, I think, most of the time, because you don't expect them to be like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what we, yeah. And we talk about that in that episode, different childhood killers that you would just not expect, like sweet little girls that
like
go
Mary
and,
Bell.
Yeah, that mm-hmm. go and kill other sweet little innocent children and leave these creepy messages. And
we murder so that we may come back. I mean, what 9-year-old can come up with this?
Yeah.
And she's still out there. Yeah. She was released from prison.
She's been like put in some kind of witness protection, and no one knows where she is or who she is, but she has grandchildren and seems to be doing well. So,
right. Our most recent episode is we have Slender Man and the Slender Man stabbings with the two girls that stabbed their friend. Because they're supposedly obsessed with Slender Man. Mm-hmm. It's just another just really creepy kind of aspect of what children are capable of that you would never expect.
Well, that was fun, because when I started talking about the Slender Man murders, I was like, okay, so there are these 3 girls, and it's like one of them's 13th birthday, and they're all getting together for a slumber party, and they go to Skateland, and then they come home, and he's like, are you making this up? I was like, no, that's actually like literally what happened. Like, that's actually in the newspaper. Honest to God, they went to Skateland and had a slumber party, and they tried to murder their friend. Like, it sounds so made up, but it sounds like
creepypasta all by itself.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you know what's really interesting about that story is that, you know, the entity that they're talking about is a made up entity, you know, mm-hmm. comes from, as you said, creepypasta. But, you know, it's always something that I wonder about is like when you're creating these characters and you're bringing forth these things. I mean, we talk about tulpas and, you know, thought forms and making things real by putting so much energy into them, is what do we bring forth when we bring forth these characters and create these legends? Is there something more to it than just, you know, our desire to believe? Is it something that we're actually pulling from the ether?
Well, that's the great thing we love about urban legends, is that it's not one guy that writes it. It's oral history. It is written sometimes, but there's so many contributors. So you are getting that energy. You're getting that, you know, those ideas from everybody, and it really does encapsulate the culture because you have so many people. And like the guy that invented Slender Man, there's a great quote from him saying that he was trying to create cooperative folklore. Mm-hmm. And it's what he did.
Right.
He succeeded.
And there's a movie coming out soon.
Yeah.
Like, it was optioned for a movie. Like, I mean, I saw that like 2 days ago.
So this is recent news. Yeah, I did not hear about that.
Yeah, I mean, super recent news. I doubt they have anything. You know, it's very, very pre-production. But it's interesting. It's even getting that high. Everyone
God, I want Doug Jones to play him. Can we just? Oh, yeah. Sorry. I digress.
So how much research goes into every episode? Do you guys start pretty early for that? And, you know, do you work ahead towards an episode?
Well, like we try to bank a few episodes at a time.
Yeah.
We literally will finish recording and we'll look at each other and be like, okay, so what do we want to do next?
A lot of research. I mean, we put a lot of research. Like everyone that comments, I was like, wow, this is so well researched. Like we probably spend way too much time on this.
If we hired a research assistant, they'd be like, you don't pay me enough to do this. Like, I don't think it's because we like to, and because we're naturally curious people, that this works. It's also fun. And I think we're able to do it to the level that we do. We probably spend like 12 hours at least.
Well, no more, because a lot of times Sam's a graphic artist. And so she listens to books while she's working. So Sam's read at least one or two books by the time we are doing an episode. And then I do a lot of research into like, if it's a psych stuff or science stuff, I'll go and read the papers on it.
I'll be like, can you use your journal access and find out more about X? And I'll like give him the name of some obscure psychiatrist I've run across or whatever. And he can go and actually access medical journals, which is nice. But yeah, I guess I don't know how many hours of research we do for each episode. A lot.
One thing we love doing is just making interesting connections to things. And like, so we did one on, we wanted to tell Sam had read Starvation Heights, which is about Linda Hazard. And she ran this really weird hospital coming thing where she starved people as a cure for things.
Everything. It cured everything. You'd be amazed.
And we've read through Jan van Braun's Encyclopedia of Urban Legends like 1,000 times and read through a ton of websites about just lists of urban legends. And one thing you see frequently is like diets, like just weird diets. And we're like, well, we can incorporate that. And we did that and Kellogg and then talked about like anorexia and bulimia.
And like pro-Anna websites and kind of the modern culture that's grown up around those with young girls. And it went some really interesting places. And it was another one of those legends that's like, oh, the Dolly Parton diet, that's an idiotic thing. I don't want to talk about that for an hour, but we never do. You know, like it's just a jumping off point to kind of make other connections. So yeah, a lot of research. And I think that, like I said, we're able to do that because we get to change gears completely every week. We try to really never do two back to back that are too similar. Like we kind of have different categories, like unofficial categories. Yeah. We're like, have we done a murder in a while? Because I feel like the last murder we did wasn't like a murder. And so we'll do that. And then we might have like a true classic urban legend that we try to do. And one that's like more about psych and more about like culture and sociology. And
like scary, really scary story.
Paranormal. We try to do some of that sometimes too.
Kind of loosely alternate between those and try to decide just to get a really good mix.
Yeah. And it's nice. A completely different flavor every week.
Yeah, that's the really cool thing about what you're doing is it lends itself to a lot of different variety. So, you know, you mentioned, Linda Hazard. unlike her diet plan, which consisted basically of oranges and tomatoes, you have a lot more that you can explore. You know, it's not a two-note thing, which is really cool.
And sometimes we do things that are a little bit of a stretch. Like we just recorded an episode we're really excited about. And it's the Gay Mafia, which is, you know, not something that you're going to see on urban legend lists, but it's like something that keeps popping up when stupid people talk on microphones. They say things about the Gay Mafia. So it's really quite funny.
Yeah.
So we were able to take that and go back into like the Lavender Scare and, you know, the ideas about, you know, gay artists controlling America and all this stuff.
And it is about the stories that were told about those people and how that kind of idea developed about that. Like, well, we always like to say what your crazy uncle says.
Yeah. You know? Like the thing that your really offensive relative says.
Yeah. And like, so where did those ideas come from? Why is that the story people keep telling? Why do people always associating gay with being a sissy boy? And it's actually related to like psychological texts from the 50s and 60s.
Like that was actually in the text. Like that's a direct quote from a real psychiatrist who wrote real books, and it makes me crazy. But Yeah. Wow. So we do a lot of different stuff, a lot of jumping around.
Now, I'm very curious as to what both of your backgrounds are, because there's definitely, like, I can tell just through your conversation that you both seem to really enjoy the research, and there seems to be, like, at least a little bit of a psychology background for both of you. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Well, I was an English major.
God, cultural studies.
Yeah, I majored in writing and culture, and I minored in anthropology and linguistics and studied folklore. So that's my crazy background. And now I edit and color comics. So I have kind of an all over the place background. And then Jacob. Yeah.
I'm a pediatrician.
He's a pediatrian. So.
But so I do a lot of, you know, background in science and psychology, and I've done research and stuff like that. So
that's
okay.
That's really cool. Yeah. So you've done your studies in folklore, which is really cool. I actually, was it two seasons ago? I had the privilege of interviewing some storytellers that were really versed in folklore and had done their doctorates and that type of thing. And it was really eye-opening to see kind of how these ideas and these ways of sharing information have changed, but still stay the same as we, you know, move forward in time.
Yeah. I think of some of the texts you read in school where it was like an entire book of Cinderella stories.
Mm-hmm. That was fabulous. Like, yeah, we spent a semester looking at just Cinderella from the Iberian Peninsula specifically. Like it didn't even go further than that. You know, like it just took that story and looked at different versions of it and like different tellings, which is great because they try to preserve like little verbal tics and stuff when they're actually collecting stories for study. Mm-hmm. And so you have like this really foul mouthed old woman telling the Cinderella story. And like in one version of Cinderella in Spain, she dresses as a pelican to approach the prince. And I don't know why that is. I really wish I did. I cannot remember for the life of me what the pelican was about. I just know it happened. And I remember my professor, who's this like adorable little Cuban woman, like standing up at the front reading from the book going, "Pelican, why are you shitting on the floor? Pelican, pelican, why are you shitting on the floor?" And it's like, that is my degree. That's pretty much like what I got to do. That moment was worth all of it. So yes, I quite enjoyed my studies in folklore, and the pelican shits on the floor in Cinderella somewhere in Spain.
That's awesome.
So, that's amazing.
I was at the National Storytelling Festival in Jonesboro, Tennessee last year, and one of the tellers by the name of Adam Booth told a story called Ashton, which is based in Appalachia. He's from West Virginia, so he used a lot of the Appalachian culture and memes and things like that to, you know, kind of pour into the story, but it's essentially a retelling of Cinderella, and it was done really, really well.
People who really work at assembling new and relatable versions of those really old tales do something amazing. It takes a lot of work to pull the essential elements out and find kind of the cultural analog that fits for everything. Cause you can't have a castle in Appalachia,
right?
You know, like what are you going to put there? And I think that's really interesting and very creative work,
but it fits so much with the idea of folklore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, that it is this ever growing, ever changing. It fits with your current, you know, sociological area that you're at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's so many versions of these stories, and we reinvent them constantly as we move forward. But there's some of these elements that are true and tried and stay the same. Another storyteller that was a presenter there, but I had a chance to listen to her tell here in Pittsburgh. Lynn Ford is also from the Appalachian region, and she told a story about being a child going to school, and the teacher would tell, I don't remember what the story was. It may have been Little Red Riding Hood or Cinderella or something that the teacher told. And she gets to the end of the story, and Lynn, as a child, is there, and she's like, "You know what? That's not the way the story goes. This is the way it goes, because this is the way my grandpa told it." But I thought that's really interesting because it just really speaks to, you know, how things change and how we put our own little twist on things as stories go along.
And we may only hear those stories told, you know, from our grandpa or whatever, but they become ours. Yeah. You know, like she felt ownership over that. And that's what makes stories so great, is we internalize them and they really become part of the stories we tell ourselves, which form our identity.
Absolutely. So what do you guys have planned for the future and upcoming episodes? You said you work a little bit ahead. What can we look forward to?
Well, we have the second installment of Creepypasta coming out. I think tomorrow we're going to post that. It was our 25th episode extravaganza. We talked for a really long time and drank a lot of wine. It was super fun.
Yeah, I always worry about the the cohesiveness of things by the time we get to the hour, because we usually drink like a bottle of wine by the time we're
done. Yeah, and like when we went over an hour, I was like, I hope that last part makes sense, because it was like the closing. We really wanted to like bring the point home. I was like, God, oh, I hope we did that.
We've never done that on Ninth Story.
Yeah.
We had Lavender Scare. We're going to do, we're going to do The Old Hag soon.
Yeah, Sleep Paralysis.
Awesome.
And we're also planning one on camp. Campfire stories and stories about summer camp and things like that. We're going to talk about murdery murder in that episode, so I'm excited.
That's really cool.
I like the murdery murder episodes. Jacob doesn't get as into murdery murder. He's like, you just keep your little true crime self over there and let me know how it goes.
Yeah, yeah, you do the murdery murder. That's fine, man.
And then we are also wrapping up Audio Dime Museum, which is our other show. We're getting ready to put out the season finale of that. So that is what I am working on right now. I have to write it, which is always the hardest part. I can research forever. But actually sitting down and composing is very difficult.
Yeah, and that's more of our true storytelling podcast. We have a frame story, almost like in a similar way to how you have Veronica. Victoria. Victoria.
He still gets my name wrong. Don't worry.
I call the kids by the dog's name. Yeah, he does. It happens.
If she's offended, Victoria will visit you this evening and tap you on the shoulder and let you know that you messed up.
I have a feeling next time in an elevator, I'm going to see her with her little music box.
Like, wait a minute. There's only four stories in this building. What do you mean we're going to eight?
Yeah.
And so that's our storytelling podcast. But we actually, we have that frame story. And then while they are, written by Sam, vast majority written by Sam, they are historical stories that take a true real life events and characters and tell them in kind of an interesting way, again, to go with that theme of, what do these things say about us? What does it say about, the people, the society we live in, the people we're around?
Yeah. So our last installment of that is coming up. And then I think we're going to do a season two. So, nice. But we're going to be out of the Dime Museum.
That's really cool. See, now I did not know about the other podcast.
Yeah, check it out. I mean, I think you'll like it if you like this different storytelling stuff. We've had so much growth, so many listeners, and so we'll probably do another volume, and that'll be in a few months. But the whole first season will be up probably by the time this is up.
Yeah, I'm reading through the description in iTunes. Let's see, merging the suspenseful style of mystery with the conventions of ghost stories. So there's going to be a strong horror bent to this, I'm assuming.
There's always kind of people always say they get goosebumps when they hear
it. It's got a real creep factor, but there are mostly true stories. And if they're not stories, they're legends, like that are very much associated with particular places or things. The first episode is like a Civil War story. Second is about Leopold and Loeb. So that's 1920s Chicago.
And murder story.
A murdery murder. I needed one.
And then we do have a real good ghost story from Louisiana.
It's we're both from Louisiana originally. And I think that's where a lot of our fascination with storytelling comes from, because people don't talk there. They tell stories. Even if they're telling you about going to the grocery store, it's an epic. it's never just like, and I did this. It's like, you will not believe what happened to me.
Yeah, the sitting around drinking, telling stories is a big part of the culture we grew up in.
Yeah.
No, and I always had that kind of that feeling for that region that would be something that would be very prevalent in that culture.
It absolutely is. I don't know how they would get through the day if they were limited to one sentence. communication. No. Like, I can't imagine it. Also, if you tie their hands behind their back, they would not be able to speak. So,
yeah, I will have kids in my clinic like laugh about me talking with my hands.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, it's so, just like the Italian culture too. It's like nothing's a one word answer. That doesn't exist. It's a very long, dramatic reading.
Yeah, I think the French and Italians like have a lot of similarities. Food, yeah, conversation, music.
Talking with your hands. They're all basically the same people.
Yeah, really, it's the Roman Empire disseminated. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. When I fell in love with my in-laws was when Easter, I think we were at Mom Jay's, like his grandmother's house, and they started talking. They noticed this Mary statue that she had sitting around, because every woman in South Louisiana has a couple Mary statues sitting around.
Right.
And they're like, oh my God, Mom Jay, you still have that. And apparently they, like all of her children, all of Jacob's aunts and uncles got drunk on prom night and ran over this Virgin Mary statue on their way home.
Oh,
and
no.
So their natural like response was to take it and bury it in the backyard. And like one day somebody accidentally said something about Mom Jay about it in front of Mom Jay after they'd moved. And she like went back to their old house and dug up the Virgin Mary statue and pieced it back together. And now it's sitting on their back porch all back together. And I just loved that so much. I loved all of the steps of that. I thought it was so funny and so fabulous. And I was like, okay, I can deal with these people. They're great.
That's tremendous. Love that. Jeanette, I know you had a bag of questions. Why don't you go ahead with some of yours?
Oh. We touched on some of them.
Okay.
I was curious about the origin of your podcast specifically. How did you guys first get into this?
We've been joking that like we should just record this shit for years. Like seriously, like when we're talking to each other, we're like, this is...
Because we would have these conversations, like one of us would read a book or we'd see a news article or something, and we'd sit around, drink wine, and talk for an hour after the kids go to bed about this stuff. And yeah, I was like running one day and I was like, came home and I was like, oh my God, we should do a podcast.
So we literally sit down with the 2004 MacBook.
Yes.
And our like iPhone earbuds and like free software and recorded the first couple of episodes. And we were like, no, it's fun. We should keep doing this.
Yeah. We got a great response and then just maybe updated our software and our technology. And it's just grown ever since. And we love doing it. Can't imagine not.
No, it's like, it's what we talk about a lot of the time. But I mean, like we would sit down and download after Mad Men for like 2 hours, you know, every episode we just talk about it. And so we've always kind of talked about text, whether we meant to or not. And
and I've always been interested in folklore, even though I didn't go into like studying it. I read all of Jan van Braan's books on urban legends when I was a kid, when I was like in middle school. And I read the Foxfire books, which are books about folktales in Appalachia. If you're interested, it's great. Lots of that primary source material. There's a great one that was published in the 80s that's a similar one in Louisiana called Gumbo Yaya.
Is that Robert?
I can't. No, I don't think Robert Johnson. No, is it Robert? I don't think he read it. Robert Talent. Robert Talent wrote a great book on voodoo folklore, which I also read. But Gumbo Yaya is a great book about Louisiana folklore, doing this primary sources again, going straight to your old grandma and collecting it in that, you know, Cajun French pidgin English dialect. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's so entertaining if you're interested in stuff like that.
That sounds really cool.
We have a 5-year-old, and because I'm his mom, he has I can never remember the guy's name. Help me. Mm-hmm. Richard that wrote Scary Stories, Stall in the Dark. I can't remember his name.
Alvin Schwartz.
Alvin Schwartz. I always want to call him Richard, which is probably why I can't remember his name. but Alvin Schwartz, like those books, they're with the new illustrations, but I went and bought all of them and we've read them all like 10 times each now.
And those are all based on old folklore, which I didn't know as a kid, but they're all based on urban legends and old folklore. And I thought there's a documentary supposed to come out next year and you can watch the like extended trailer for it talking about how banned it was you know, when we were kids. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. but it was also the most popular book at the in the school libraries. Kids wanted to read this. They had a thirst for these legends, these modern urban legends and folklore. But people were worried because they really were very, you know, they're kind of scary. The pictures were extremely disturbing. No, it was
the pictures. That was banned because of the pictures. I don't believe anything else you tell me.
it was definitely the pictures. They were so
disturbing. Were so creepy. Although Harold, like, I was reading to my son, and the one about the scarecrow that, like, kills the guy and lays his skin on the roof. I changed the ending very quickly, mid-story, because it was like, oh, God. And, like, that's really scary.
That was Scary Stories 3, wasn't it?
I think so.
Yeah, because I remember there was one of them that had a cover with a scarecrow on it.
And so, see, all those illustrations are changed now. It makes me so sad.
Yeah, or a witch or something.
Appropriate for a five-year-old.
Yeah, they do. But, yeah.
I know.
Those illustrations were just like the most disturbing memories of most of our childhoods.
100%. Yeah, for sure.
Absolutely.
It's sad. I miss out on them now.
So, Jeanette, is that how you got into the doing the horror drawings?
It was definitely a factor, for sure. I loved those books. I read the crap out of them.
Yeah, me too. No, those illustrations are amazing. I was looking at, I will go sometimes and just Google them and just look at them because mm-hmm. they're still pretty.
These are black and white, watercolor, just these surreal, disturbing images. If you do not know what we're talking about, go Google it.
Yeah.
Pause. Seriously.
We'll have to put at least one of the illustrations in the show notes just so that people can get a taste of it.
Yeah, definitely.
Good luck picking one because they're at least they're just amazing. Like I could think of they like really 10. That,
it's good stuff.
I think we touched on this also, but for each episode, do you find that your research method changes for each topic, or do you tend to like Sam? I know you were listening to the books, and but how do you approach each episode with your research?
It does change depending on topic. Like it depends on if we know we're kind of cobbling a lot of different ideas together. We'll sometimes segment it. Like I'll be like, okay, so I'm going to cover, like we'll make a loose outline and I'm like, okay, so these are the points I want to hit. And I'll take the, you know, history and I'll take the, you know, social implications and you'll do psych and medical and we kind of look at that and we'll segment it that way. And then sometimes it's just a big flowy topic and we're going to talk about it for an hour and we'll both like, I'll be like, I actually did like this book I read. You should listen to it. Or, you know, we kind of pass the same sources back and forth. With Audio Dime, I do a lot more primary source research and I'm on like newspaper archives and pulling up books from, you know, one of the books I read was from like 1827 or late 1700s. I just read a full text description of a shipwreck and that kind of stuff. So that has a different flavor.
We watch documentaries sometimes, we watch the movies we talk about. We watch, we do try to go to the primary sources. So like when we did Psycho, we watched all the newsreels from that time about it. And we watched the original Hitchcock promotions that he did for it. Already, I like reading books, reading journal articles, news articles. We pull from, I mean, we have tons of sources for each episode.
We really should put up sources. We should list our sources. We should do that.
I'm definitely interested in like, what are your favorite?
You just became a robot, Jeanette.
I know, it was kind of amazing.
Oh,
I thought I was kind of scared for a second.
Victoria showed up.
I thought she was coming for me.
She really doesn't like that you messed up her name.
That's right.
I was before I turned into a robot, let me put my skin mask back on. What are your favorite places to find sources? What are your favorite sources to go to?
Google Books is an awesome resource.
Yeah, we highly patronize Google Books because it's free. So that's awesome. Mm-hmm.
But they have all those primary sources. Like, they have few hundred year old articles about things. And and they also have, like, Alan Dundee's is this Freudian folklorist that we love to cite because he has these crazy ideas about things, and his books are on there, and Jan van Braan's and other folklore texts are on there.
I mean, like, if you want to look up court cases, if you want to pull up news articles.
Right, we did, like, Elisa Lam. We talked about Elisa Lam in one episode, and we were able to pull up, like, her coroner's report, and I read through that.
Yeah, I was like, Jacob, I would be like, what is, and I'm like 10 syllables in, he's like, just give it to me. I know it's artery murder, but just give it to me. But yeah, like we've been able to access a lot of cool things through there. Mm-hmm. I also use the National Archives a lot. And I subscribe to Audible and use those credits up real quick. and I don't think there's not like a,
watch documentaries on Netflix. Yeah. We always, if we could find a good one, like there's a great one on sleep paralysis that,
we seen watched
that kind of, that kind of inspired us that we plan on doing that one fairly soon.
Yeah.
Like we said, to space out the creepy episodes.
Yeah. So we did a creepypasta and talked about Slenderman. So we're probably going to wait
a few weeks
to do that. But yeah, we pull from all over the place. And I think that's one thing that makes it fun is we really do try to track down stuff that feels true to the subject matter. So like I'll read a true crime book, you know, like one of those paperback throwaways for certain episodes, because it's like, oh yeah, that's where you're going to find the stuff about Edmund Kemper or whatever. Like, you know, like we try to fit it to whatever we're researching. And it changes all the time.
What's the most surprising thing that you've discovered in doing your research? Maybe something that you believed was true and you found out was not, or vice versa.
It's usually vice versa.
Yeah.
It's usually things that we're like, oh, urban legend. Yeah, we've heard this since we were kids. I can't, holy shit, there are real stories.
Like, sometimes I'll be like reading and I'll just like hit him on the shoulder. I'm like, it happened. Oh my God, it happened. Like I remember the Avon Lady episode. I found an incident where there was a guy dressed in a children's Cinderella costume who attacked a woman in a bathroom. And I was like, no man goes into a ladies' room dressed as a lady to beat up ladies. That's stupid. And then I was like, oh, okay. Well, it happened that one time at Big Lots, but you know, whatever. like
those that one time down there at the Big Lots.
It really wasn't Big Lots. And it really wasn't a kid's Cinderella costume. Like, a lot of times I'm like, this sounds so made up. That was definitely one. We were researching the hotel episode.
Oh yeah.
Like to find out that there really are more suicides at hotels. That people, like local people who check into hotels, their risk for suicide goes up something like 30% or I can't remember the statistic, but it's insane. That research is crazy because, you know, they're going away from home so that their loved ones don't have to discover them and clean up the mess.
Mm. And since I'm not into murder like you are, every time you find these crazy cases of people that have done these insane things, I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe that's actually real. I can't believe there really was this killer that was killing people in Lover's Lane. I can't believe there really were.
Mary Bell, still crazy. Like the 9-year-old English girl that killed the two kids.
And Kemper, you know, one of these guys that really was picking up hitchhikers and killing them. And so interesting.
Yeah, and insane. Edmund Kemper has some of the best YouTube videos that you will ever see in your life. Like, if you want to just feel bad about humanity for a whole day, you should go listen to his interviews because they're, like, you can't look away. It's like a car accident. And he's so intelligent. And it's just, like, he's this guy. And he's, like, 6'9 and weighs 300 pounds. And you can tell he's just off the charts smart. And he's sitting there talking about, like, when I see a cute girl, I don't know if I want to take her on a date or put her head on a stake. Well, I'm like,
or like in the Psycho episode, I knew about Ed Gein, who's the serial killer that he's kind of based on. But I did not know the details, and to see like the pictures of what he did with the the bodies and creating, Ed Gein was the inspiration for Psycho, but also Buffalo Bill,
and he checks his chainsaw. Yeah. Like he's had his day.
But that he actually did create body suits out of people's skin and things like that, and just being able to see the images of it online, just extremely disturbing.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was from Wisconsin, right?
He was from Wisconsin. Proud day for them.
Yeah.
Ed Gein and cheese.
You know, they recently auctioned off some of his stuff.
Yeah. Zach Baggins or however he says his name from Ghost Hunters, Dude Bro.
We know who he is.
Yeah. And he bought the cauldron that he used to boil the skulls down in and stuff like that.
Yeah, Jacob sent me that text, sent me the news article, a screen cap, and he's just like, bro. And I was like,
hey. People must get bored in the Midwest, I'll tell you. Because Gacy's from Illinois, so, there's that corridor through there.
And apparently the Pacific Northwest in California is just, crazy, too.
Well, we talk about frequently that when we were going to college, there was a serial killer in Baton Rouge.
Baton Rouge, Red Stick,
Baton Rouge, serial killer. And what was his name?
Derek Todd Lee.
Oh, yeah. So we grew up in our formative years with that constant threat that if you don't look behind your back, this serial killer is going to come and get you.
Don't let anybody in. If you see something, say something. It was very much everyone was on notice because he was actively killing students. He was not coming into dorms and stuff. It was mainly off campus housing, but at LSU, very few people lived on campus. A lot of people would, be in little houses or apartment buildings. Mm-hmm. So that was scary. We started college.
Everyone had tasers and you had a little pink mace bottle on your taser.
I did. I never used it. And I don't ever know what happened to it, which I should probably know that. So we had our serial killer experience. That was super fun. There are a lot of Louisiana and Texas. Oh, everything happens in Texas. That's actually true.
Really?
A lot of serial killers and things. Yeah, a lot of bad stuff.
We haven't talked about the one in Galveston yet in Houston. Yeah. That'll happen one day. That's a disturbing one. And Baton Rouge is the guy that was the art distributor for Gacy. He's the one that talked to Gacy and would go to the prison and get his artwork and sell it.
Oh, yeah. All his clown paintings, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He lives in Baton Rouge. He's in the documentary. What's the documentary?
Oh, it's by the same guy that did I want to say Howard Hughes, and I know that's not right.
He's the same guy that did the H.H. Holmes documentary. I can't remember what it's called, but it's a pretty good one. It's about people's obsession with serial killers.
Serial killer memorabilia and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I don't collect that. I'm not that into murdering murder.
You'll just research it.
I'll just research it and get, oh my God.
Yeah, it's interesting, but you don't want to surround yourself with it, right?
No, and I don't I have no desire to write to someone. That's I don't, it does not translate that way.
No.
For me.
I understand completely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Fun on paper, but I'm not gonna actually be connected.
Exactly. Yeah. It's fun to research and to explore the darker side of humanity, but to actually be participatory is a little different.
Yeah, it's beyond I want some glass between me and the crazy. It's I want some states between me and the crazy. If I ever find out anyone's even imprisoned close to where I am, I'm very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
The Canadian serial killer that got out. You were I'm never going to Canada.
Yeah. I was their prison sentences are nothing in Canada. You get 25 years no matter how many murders you commit. That's a life sentence and you can't get more than that. And so Jacob will be we're moving to Canada over something. And I'm nope. Not going. Oh, they let their murderers roam free. The guy on the bus is the one that really freaked me out. You know, the guy that decapitated the other guy on the bus, the Greyhound bus.
Oh,
yeah. Oh, yeah. He's right. You're kidding me.
Because it's Canada. And apparently that's a thing.
What's wrong with you, Canada?
I know.
He said, Jesus. Oh, you know, it was a bad
thing. He didn't mean it.
It's okay. We forgive you. Don't do it again. And that's not a Canadian accent, but, you know, that's more sure. like.
It's very Fargo. I liked it.
It was very Fargo.
that's what my family in Coopersville, Michigan sounds like. Hey, family, if you can hear me.
My family sounds like swamp people.
So. They do. That's actually true. That's not an exaggeration. Yeah. Like, when I saw swamp people and I'd been away from that family, that side of the family for a long time, I, like, got homesick and wanted to go visit.
Yeah. That's
my
tremendous.
Family is, like, more East Texas. We're in Louisiana, but we sound like East Texas and have thick Southern accents. And when I go home, my husband picks on me relentlessly when I get back because I say things that sound like they are made up from hee-haw.
You start to slip back into the accent then?
Oh, so badly.
Yeah,
that's funny. I do the same thing. I slip into accents like no one's business. Like when we talk to Mark from across the pond, I have a hard time not just going British on him because I don't know why, but accents just slip into my head and then I get stuck in them.
But you lived in Scotland, not England. I don't understand.
I can also do that one.
Yeah. It's not Scottish, it's crap. Fiona.
And then I kind of get stuck in it, but that's a little bit more Irish rather than Scottish. I can't quite do Scottish.
No, that's very Irish. Wow. That's very Irish.
I've got a
very
great good. Georgian accent because that's where I grew up, where I learned to speak, rather. But now I can't pull it out. Hang on.
You become self-conscious, huh?
Just some sort of a Southern belle. There you go. It sort of slips in there.
Just it's say not, bless your heart and it all comes back whether you want it or not. When I went home the last time, my mom said something. She's like, well, you know, so-and-so, you know, they've got themselves a wood colt. And I was like, what in God's name are you talking about? Like, and she's like, a wood colt.
A wood colt.
Like, mother, I don't know what you mean. You're going to, and she's like, you know, when they don't know who the daddy is. And I'm like, how is that a thing? Like, you've been hiding this from me for years. I grew up here. I feel like I should know. I feel like you just made that up to be weird and freak me out now that I live in a city. Like, I don't think that's a thing. But she does stuff like that all the time.
Well, no, the other day when I was at your house and your mom actually said, that family over yonder.
Yeah.
And I literally died laughing.
Yeah. And he comes in the house the other day and hears me going, Mama, how is Miss Lily Mae? And just dies. Like, he's like, Samantha, you can't say that without an accent.
Family over yonder.
Yeah.
It's
Miss Lily Mae.
Oh, that's tremendous. We have a rich variation of accents in this country. It's so much fun.
It is a lot of fun.
So, Jeanette, I think your last question, I'm looking at our show notes, is what was the most, I'm going to ask it because I'm looking at it. What is the most disturbing urban legend you've ever researched? That's a great one.
Oh, the lavender scare we just researched, I actually found that quite disturbing, but in a very different way. It was amazing how actively people in positions of power were working against, you know, lesbian and gay people during the 1950s and 60s, like just the amount of agency and forethought that went into actively damaging their quality of life was very upsetting to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's amazing. Well, you know, how we can devolve into these, I don't know, petty and very disturbing campaigns against people just because they're different.
Yes.
Yeah. And something that we went to some...
Oops, sorry. It's thundering.
Thunderstorm.
Perfect.
And so one of the really disturbing ones, an early one we did was Meet His Murder, which is a story. We didn't take it from it, but the story is in Scary Stories Tell in the Dark about the guy that turns his wife into sausage. And that was interesting because it was true.
Yeah. Oh,
and then we started delving into different kind of cannibalistic people that had eaten other people, and other times where that we actually even found a Russian was he, like a meat kebab distributor?
Well, homeless people had killed some people and sold the meat to a kebab distributor in Russia.
Oh, wow.
And he served it.
And he served it. So people had gone up and bought kebabs, as you would do on the street in New York or whatever, and eaten them. And it turned out that those were human flesh.
That's the best sausage I ever had. Can I have some more of that, please?
This is so good.
Exactly. So, yes, Sweeney Todd is real.
Oh, my gosh. Careful what you buy, folks.
That's right.
It might be people.
It's Soylent Green, and you didn't even know it.
Exactly.
I think I said Soylent Green like 10 times on the episode, and I think Jacob put it all out. Like, it would nonstop.
Soylent Green is people.
I love The Twilight Zone. Rod Serling is my boyfriend. Oh, so. Yeah.
It's the same movie.
I know. But all he right. didn't. Rod Serling.
I don't know. I don't think so. He wrote Planet of the Apes.
Okay. And Charlton Heston was in both. Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. I amalgamated. It happens. I just played 9 degrees of Kevin Bacon or whatever by myself. So.
Well, this is probably a good place for me to give you guys an opportunity to talk about your where folks can find and interact with you and where we can subscribe to the podcasts, plural.
Okay, so we have Audio Dime Museum, which is a serialized storytelling podcast that functions around historical stories and kind of takes motifs from mystery and horror genres. And it's, sorry, we're getting thunder.
Oh, see, you can't buy that kind of atmosphere.
Seriously.
It was a dark and stormy night.
Yes.
Oh, and there's a frame story featuring a character called the curator. And the other character in the story is you, which has led to some who's on first debates, but it's just you and the curator. And that is an ongoing story every week. And then each week we take an artifact from the Dime Museum and discuss the history and tell the story. And we're wrapping that. We're about to finish up season one, and you can find that on iTunes at Audio Dime Museum. And
we're currently like number one for new and noteworthy on the performing arts section.
We finally overtook the Hamilton podcast.
Yes. Awesome.
Screw you, Alexander Hamilton.
We went all Aaron Burr up in there.
Aaron Burr.
That's terrible.
Right. And our other our original podcast, and it's a weekly podcast, is Just a Story, the Urban Legend Podcast. And you search Just a Story. We're a history, folktale, urban legend podcast where we discuss all of the different things. Like we said, you're taking these urban legends and having them as jumping off points to look into our society and humanity and psychology and science and anything else we can fit into an hour long episode.
Right. And so you can get us on Twitter at Just a Story Pod. You can email us at Just a Story Pod at Gmail, or you could send a carrier pigeon and we would accept that.
Awesome. Yes. So I guess I'll ask you one final question. What advice do you have for listeners out there that hear your show and are inspired to try to create something of their own in the same genre?
Don't be afraid to follow rabbits. Like, something may seem like a fleeting idea that seems like something that's sort of off topic, but if you pursue it and do just a little more research, it could turn into a unique connection that really sets your analysis or understanding apart.
Yeah, I agree. Just follow your passion. You have to be super interested in it. And like we, for whatever reason, are. And, you know, that's something that's going to lead to a great product if you care about it.
Yeah, I think that's really a big part of it. For, you know, to not to be afraid to explore different directions and to go in different directions and to make sure that what you're putting out there is something that you're passionate about, because podcasting and storytelling in general is not easy work, regardless of what form you choose to tell your story in. So if you're not inspired and you're doing it just because you want to try to get listeners or followers or make money, it's not going to sustain you in the long haul. It needs to be something that you really would do without being paid.
Yeah, and we've had people in it because we have the numbers to where we could make it a profitable venture, and that may happen in the future, but that's so at the bottom of our priority list.
Yeah,
people are just constantly like, I can't believe you're not doing this and doing that. And we're like, we're focusing on the show right now, and it's a hobby.
Yeah.
And we just really enjoy doing it, and it's much cheaper than marriage counseling.
Yeah. All we need is a microphone and wine, and we will be okay.
Yeah.
And like, we have re-recorded episodes, we've trashed ideas, and we're deep into research. Like, if they're just not coming together, we can't find the right angle, we're not excited about it, we'll drop it. And I think that's something we hold ourselves to a standard that is important to me personally. Like, I don't want to put something out that people can tell we're not invested in or we didn't love, you know?
Right. Absolutely. That's hugely, hugely important. That's why you guys are doing so great and why you're being so successful. I mean, you have the right philosophy about this. It's something to enjoy and to try to bring joy to your lives and pass that along to others. I mean, if it's something that you enjoy, you're going to find your audience, and you obviously have. So,
yeah, I agree 100%.
We really do love doing it.
Well, I want to thank you so much for taking so much time on a dark and stormy night to sit down and talk about stories and storytelling and serial killers and all kinds of fun stuff.
Isn't it fun? Yeah. Thank you so much for asking us. We really enjoyed it. Us.
You're still here? Well, then you're the people I want to talk to. So recently, we made the decision to go ahead and open up a Patreon account, which you can find over at patreon.com/ninth story. And those who aren't familiar with Patreon, it's patreon.com/ninth story. And what Patreon is back in the old days, as I'm sure most of you know, artists had patrons. They would sponsor their work and make sure that they had the money in order to do the work. So we create The Lift and The Wicked Library, and also this show, The Ninth Story Podcast. If you've listened to this show, in a couple episodes, the creators of different podcasts have talked about the fact that we create a lot of content for free. We put it out there because it's something that we love and we love to do. But we're not doing ourselves any favors as artists by giving our work away constantly for free. It makes it a lot easier and rewarding to do something when you have the proper equipment and the money in order to make that happen and to make it something that you're proud of. And there's lots of different things that we want to do with The Lift and The Wicked Library that are going to take money to do. So we figured it's about time that we reach out to you, the listeners, and say, hey, here's an opportunity for you to be a part of the show's growth. Here's an opportunity for you to be a part of sustaining it and making it something special to say, hey, I'm a part of making that happen. So would love to have your support for the stuff that we make. It's content that I'm pretty proud of. I think that a lot of love and a lot of effort and more time than even I believe sometimes goes into making it. And the whole goal of it is to make it sound easy, to make it sound like it's easy to do. But I can tell you, as the one doing a lot of the work, it's not easy to do. It's not easy to put something out there with that much quality on a consistent basis that I am proud of doing and proud to put my name next to. Two shows that I care a lot about and two characters that I care a lot about, as unreal as I know Victoria is, she's very real to me. And I would be doing her a disservice if I didn't make sure that my all went into it. And in order to make that happen, sometimes we have to upgrade equipment. We do have to pay for hosting. I'd love to pay the writers, the composers, and the artists something for their work, because right now they're all doing it for free because there is no budget. And aside from, you know, the money that we put into the show ourselves to pay for hosting and equipment and so on. So this is your opportunity to help us out. This is your opportunity to be a part of something really cool. So hopefully some of you will head on over to patreon.com/ninth story. Sign up. There's some really cool, I think, rewards there. And if there's something that you want, if you have an idea for a reward that you don't see there, send me an email at feedback@ninthstory.com, and we'll be happy to take a look at making some other cool stuff that you guys can get as rewards for being a part of making the show as good as it can be. I thank you. Victoria thanks you. The librarian thanks you. Looking forward to a lot more great content and making things even more special with your help.
Societies rise and societies fall. When the time comes, one society steps forward to build a better future. The Wicked Library, Kettle Whistle Radio, Ninth Story Podcast, Prog Watch, Red Horse Radio, The Lift, History Goes Bump, Listen, The M Writing Podcast, Society 13, Rebuilding Society, one podcast at a time.